Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 183 it is, and we're going to take stock as we enter 1851. In war, truth is always the first casualty. It's a military maxim attributed to Aeschylus, the father of Greek tragedy. Aeschylus actually fought in the front lines against the Persians at Marathon in 490 BC. We don't know much about the rest of his life, but we do know that his work called Persians, which was financed by Pericles, was such a success that he was invited to Sicily by Hieron of Syracuse to restage the play. His life bridged the archaic and classical ages, considered even by the ancients to be difficult and old-fashioned. Aeschylus was also quite innovative in the structures, his personnel, and the subjects of his 89 plays, of which we have only 7. Later, in 1758, Samuel Johnson penned a short item in The Idler, which included the following statement: "Among the calamities of war may be justly numbered the diminution of the love of truth by the falsehoods which interest dictates and credulity encourages." Well, credulity is a willingness to believe whatever is dished up. The lovers of social media are infected by a disease called credulity. In this series, I've endeavored to avoid relying on credulity by constantly referring to original sources, documents, oral history, cross-referencing where possible. There's nothing more important than deploying verification. Credulity is the tendency to be too ready to believe that something is real or true, often without sufficient evidence or skeptical or critical examination. It refers to a person's inclination to accept claims or assertions with little questioning. Southern African history is full of credulity being punctured by reality. Most politicians make a living out of abusing credulity. With that melodramatic introduction, let us dive into the deep pool of tangibility regarding Mlanjeni's War, the 8th Frontier War, which broke out on Christmas Day 1850. The military villages along the Tumi River were gone, burnt down, dozens of British soldiers dead, killed in Bomber Pass, or in their military villages named Auckland, Johannesburg, and Woburn. In the mountains above Tumi River, missionary Niven and his family had walked out of Kaiskamahoek and straight into a party of Amaxhosa warriors. It is true that respective Rarabe chief Nika had declared the missionaries and their homes protected, but that was 20 years ago, and the respected chief was long gone. Two wars had passed since then, and this was the 8th. Missionary Robert Niven was seeking safety. He and his family were trying to make it out of the war zone on Boxing Day 1850. However, the entire territory was on fire, and as they walked behind their escort, a man we know only as Nkenye, a large group of warriors blocked their path. The warriors seized the horses and shoved Robert and his wife Rebecca around. She was an invalid, disabled by some sort of respiratory illness. Despite her illness, she had given birth to 4 children, who were also part of this little group, now facing annihilation. After taking the valuables, the warriors let them continue on their way on foot, Rebecca staggering. As they approached Tumi Mission, another group of warriors stood in their way, led by Chief Kaimpi. What happened next is recorded by both Niven and Amaxhosa herders who witnessed the event. An extraordinary moment, one of those emotional and yet inexplicable things that happen in the middle of a war. As the Niven family reached the summit of the Amatolas, they looked down into the Tumi Valley where the military villages were still smoking, ruined, and then along the valley they saw the red painted figures, the ochre-covered Amaxhosa warriors, running about. Despite this danger, Niven decided to continue down the side of the Amatolas towards the valley, into the Valley of Death. On we went, discoursing on faith and providence, eyeing now and then the dark figures which we saw surely and fast approaching. The warriors reached Niven's group and shouted, "Who are you?" When Niven explained he was a missionary, an older warrior said, "You are a teacher. That man is not." He pointed at Bell, Niven's carpenter. "He must die like the white men who are killing us." While all of that was going on, a large party of Amaxhosa women lined up behind Niven's group. They were armed with clubs. He turned to them begging for water. His wife was on her last legs. They refused, saying the men would kill them for helping anyone. Niven wrote later that this, from the tender-hearted Xhosa woman, was like a sentence of death. The smoke swirled in the air, the midsummer sounds, cicadas, Christmas beetles, birds tweeting. Everything, sounds, smells, seemed to ring like the script for an Aeschylus play. Rebecca fainted, Niven caught her, and seemed then determined to die in honour. It was possibly this distraction and fearless dignity that changed the minds of the warriors watching. They proceeded to lean on their spears. Seconds earlier, they'd been about to stab everyone. Now they watched the tearful children, and the Amaxhosa women also leaned on their clubs, staring. Cicadas buzzed and whirred all the while. Down the mountain, warriors were looting the villages, triumphantly removing traces of the hated veterans who desecrated Charlie's grave. Then one of the older Xhosa women stepped forward and remonstrated with the warriors, and by doing so saved the Niven family lives. There was a confab, and it was decided that two of the elder warriors would then escort the family to safety. That Xhosa woman brought milk for the Niven children. Seconds later, another party of warriors emerged from the bush and made straight for this group. After discovering Niven was a man of the cloth, they also took aim at Ball the carpenter. He was not protected, they said. He was not a teacher. He was just another invader. Another debate ensued. The Amaxhosa woman intervened once more, and finally the two grizzled old warriors escorted the bedraggled and shattered family to Fort White. All of this didn't seem to worry Niven's youngest son, Walter, who sat on Ball's shoulders, singing as they entered the fort. The innocence of youth. Across the territory of the Eastern Cape, the Amanxika were masters of the land. Governor Harry Smith was trapped in Fort Cox, that symbolic fort, surrounded by jubilant warriors adorned with white plumes in their hair, skin lathered with ochre and animal fat. The redcoats cowered, while red ochre-smeared warriors cavorted and caroused. A delightful incongruity, a paradox, an antithesis. All the while, Governor Harry Smith, in Fort Cox, was in a spot. He was concerned about the Amanklambi clans, the Amakunukwebe. Had they joined the Amanxika in their war? He had no idea what they had decided to do, stay out of the war or join their brethren. The Amanklambi and Kunukwebe had taken a pledge months before to remain neutral, but new opportunities abounded. The entire Cape Colony was in danger. Smith knew that if the Xhaleka living across the Kai River under Paramount Sahili decided to pitch in, as well as the royal line of the Amamtembu under Chief Mapasa, the British could be facing more than 35,000 Xhosa fighters. Smith, meanwhile, could call on a measly 5,000 regular troops, perhaps a few hundred citizen force men. Worse, the regulars were now thinly spread across Transorangia and the Cape. Under duress and as usual, the British turned to the Khoi Khoi and the Boers for help. The problem was, both these people had been alienated by recent British actions. Smith's men had fought a short war against the Boers across the Orange, then annexed the territory from under their noses. The Khoi Khoi had been treated very badly indeed, particularly at the Cut River settlement. They'd been abused by British officials and settlers alike. The last chance were the Amamfengu, who'd fight for the British, but they numbered only 400. What of the few hundred Xhosa police? Before Smith had a chance to figure out how ambiguous was their support, the entire Xhosa police unit deserted on Boxing Day, taking their rifles and ammunition to join Sandile and Mlanjeni, the prophet. And the Khoi Khoi? By now, they despised the English authorities and liked the British settlers less than the Boers. It would be at least 4 months before any English troops would arrive on the frontier. If you remember, Smith's last note to Colonial Secretary Earl Grey back in England was that everything was in a state of tranquility on the frontier. Grey would only find out there was a war in March 1851, and even if he reacted on the same day, the first soldiers would only arrive in May. Ye gads, or perhaps holy smoke. So the British were up the proverbial creek without a paddle. Naturally, Smith panicked and wrote out an urgent dispatch to the Lieutenant Governor of Natal, begging him to send a Zulu army of 3,000 to attack the Amanxika from the east. Crazy, isn't it? But this made sense in 1850. Zulu King Mpandi had been interested in the English helping him take over the region we know as Eswatini, so he possibly would have sent along an army to save the English. Here was the grandiose governor, famous for parroting blacks as savages, swanning about South Africa with his red coats, begging for help from the AmaZulu King. 12 days marching, said Smith, and this 3,000 strong Mpande army could be in Kaferia, 600 or more kilometers in less than 2 weeks, and they'd be at his side. Hooray! These were the days before the telegraph, and Smith had no way of knowing what had happened to Grahamstown or any of his other towns or fortresses. Were they also smoking wrecks? Did his messenger, an Amaxhosa man, get through with orders for Henry Somerset to come to his aid? Questions, questions, questions. Smith stared out from his fort at the Xhosa rampaging about the landscape, and he must have realized that it was at this place he could die. Something appears to have snapped inside this military man because he began composing letters speaking of exterminating the Amaxhosa. The governor was coming apart at the seams. He wanted a final solution to eviscerate his enemy. Meanwhile, missionary George Brown, the Scotsman who'd taken a liking to Amaxhosa maidens and been ordered to appear at a hearing on Christmas Day, the man who left his young wife Janet and their baby behind at the Kibera mission station, was to spend possibly the most terrifying night of his life shortly at Maxhosa's feet. The Amaxhosa chief sent a message to the Tumi mission on the 27th of December 1850, saying the missionaries were safe. Brown then rushed back to Ikubira to try and join his wife and baby, but as he approached on the 28th of December, 4 kilometres from the station, he and his escort, by the name of Totani, were confronted by 3 armed men. Brown was unaware that Janet had already taken her baby and left the station seeking shelter at Fort White. "Sit down!" the warrior shouted, and he did. Matkoma's name was in his passport, or he would have been speared on the spot. Brown and Totani were surrounded then by hundreds of warriors in seconds, and they dragged the two to Maxhosa, who was nearby. The chief was seated on a mat under a bush canopy. Brown greeted him and was invited to sit alongside the famous chief. "You are a teacher," began Maxhosa, "but why do you always leave your stations and go to the military posts when there is war?" Brown had no excuse readily available and tried to answer with care, stumbling over his explanation that he had left Scotland, his safe home where there was no war, to take a chance with the Amaxhosa, who were now at war. Maxhosa wasn't impressed and asked Brown if he had paper on him, ink and a pen. "You must write for me to Smith and ask what this war is for," he demanded, then called for his interpreter. Into our story leaps one of the most remarkable characters we've heard about thus far, a man called Hermanus Matruis. Brown was to remark later that Matruis spoke English more precisely than I've ever heard any other native do. Hermanus Matruis, otherwise known as Mkugumesh, enters our tale a large and imposing man, broad-shouldered, powerful. Hermanus means army man, or Hermann does at least, warrior, brave warrior, and comes from the German, Hermann. Matruis means sailor, and Nkungumesh means in the vanguard, at the front. These names fit the man, a warrior born of a slave sailor, a man who was always at the front of everything. Born in the last decade of the 18th century, he'd grown up in Xhosaland. Matruis lived most of his life on the increasingly well-defined border between the Cape Colony and Xhosaland itself. The frontier region, a complex zone of interaction where opportunities exist for those who can flit between the margins, those who can navigate diverging cultures. His father, an escaped slave from Cape Town, fled to the Xhosa, who refused to hand him back to the Dutch in the late 1700s. This wasn't a humanitarian act, because Matruis Sr. sought protection from Amakunukwebe, who regarded the escaped slave as a bargaining chip they could use with the Dutch. Matruis Sr. married a Xhosa woman of the Amtswara clan of Ngeno of the Kunukwebe. As Hermanus grew up, he spoke Dutch and Xhosa. Dutch from his father, Xhosa from his mother. Hermanus was one of the thousands of other young Xhosa men who went off to the Cape Colony in his teens, living on a farm in Swaga's Hoek, near Somerset East. While there, he earned cash and cattle, and he was able to use his connections to the Xhosa to escape from the quasi-bondage in which farmers in much of the Eastern Cape held their labourers at the time. Matruis went back to Xhosaland, was initiated and given the name Nkukumesh. As an earlier arrival from the colony, living amongst the Xhosa, he was in the vanguard. Matruis went to live with Chief Nqinga, who made use of his talents, which were much more than merely linguistic. Colonists and early missionaries like James Reed commented on his shrewdness, tact, his diplomacy. Even Grahamstown Journal editor and notoriously anti-coy Robert Coddington noted his personal bravery and activity. Matthäus played a complicated political game. Being able to speak Dutch, Xhosa, and English, he was hired as an interpreter by the Boers, the English as well as the Xhosa. He convinced the British that he was of royal blood. This claim was seemingly tolerated by local Xhosa once they realized what he was up to, hoodwinking the British using a kind of cultural appropriation or cultural misappropriation. However, if you can flit between cultures, why not? Matthäus did indeed flit between British and Xhosa society with ease. He was naturalized as a British citizen, while almost simultaneously Xhosa chief Nika elevated him to the status of umpakati, a counselor. Don't you find that remarkable? But his loyalties, like so many other South Africans in our history, were only to himself. His descendants say that deep down he was fighting the colonists, embedded like a half Xhosa mole in the English culture. Historian Robert Ross writes that Matthäus was like a John le Carré character. Eventually, Hermanus Matthäus found his way to the Cut River Valley and took up residence near Macoma's great place and worked for the chief as a translator. When the British expelled Macoma from the valley in 1829, Matthäus was spared, showing once again how this slippery fish, or sticky seep, as my family say, could play multiple political games. Some colonists appreciated it when he shopped Macoma, who he said was plotting to kill British officials, including Colonel Somerset. As punishment, Macoma attacked Matthäus's home in late 1829, and yet, by 1850, he had become Macoma's main translator once more. Some people really are made of Teflon. Wandering was his way, and after a period at Theopolis near Graaf Reinet, Matthäus returned to the Albany region, then headed to the town of George. By 1832, the man of a thousand faces was back in the Cut River Valley, living near Blinkwater. This is where he began to run into trouble with the British, because he ignored their stipulation about only allowing a handful of supporters on his land. He had a veritable echelon living there, a village of 16 men, dozens of hangers-on, garnered attention from the British authorities. A numerous party of blacks, Hottentots, Bushmen, Bechuanas, etc., officials sniffed in a report. Cattle raiding increased as the numbers of unnamed hangers-on increased, and the settlers blamed Matthäus. He was guilty as charged and didn't oppose his expulsion from the settlement. But a chameleon is a chameleon, and when the War of 1835 broke out, Colonel Henry Somerset hired him as his personal translator. Civil Commissioner of Albany Donald Campbell wrote that Matthäus was unfaithful and treacherous. Governor Sir Benjamin Durbin defended him, saying, "He has shown an excellent example of the Cat River people to fight gallantly in their own defence." But defence of whom? It was at the Cut River settlement that Matthäus, aka Ngumesh, had become useful, particularly when it came to moving herds of illicit cattle around. Macoma relied on him as a kind of halfway house, and by 1848 Matthäus was rich in cattle and wives, four wives to be specific, and at least 260 head of cattle, more than 40% of all the beef at the Cut River settlement. During the British raiding of that settlement just before the Eighth Frontier War, Hermanus Matthäus was targeted by settlers because he was a successful koikoi. So when Mlanjeni the Prophet had begun mobilizing people in 1850, Matthäus was more than ready to lend a hand to the uprising, having had enough of the British backstabbing. In what was later described as a shocking failure of British military intelligence, Matthäus asked the English for arms and ammunition at the start of the Eighth Frontier War, after Christmas 1850, despite clearly supporting Macoma, who'd started the war. The mercurial man managed to convince the powers that be to send him barrels of gunpowder and muskets. This is a level of chutzpah that is almost dazzling. Modern politicians are mere amateurs compared to this man's audaciousness. By the time Brown bumped into our hero interpreting for Macoma, Hermanus Matthäus was in command of at least 900 Amakosa warriors. That was a very large battalion for the time. How can we explain this phenomenon, this Jekyll and Hyde of the Eighth Frontier War? Well, as you'll hear in podcasts to come, the chameleon would eventually pay for his double, triple crossing, switching sides once too often. It's time to halt proceedings as the flames roar across the Eastern Cape. One of the most significant wars in Southern African history was well underway. please rate the episode on your favorite channel, or you can head off to the website desmondlatham.blog. You can sign up for my newsletter and read the latest updates. Until next, tot ziens.